My name is Ruby, and with Chicago chapter of the Jewish International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network.
I'm Lee.
I'm Emma.
I'm Noah.
So we're going to be talking today about anti-Semitism, about Zionism, and how to distinguish anti-Semitism from opposition to Zionism. Why are we doing this workshop? Zionist institutions frequently use charges of anti-Semitism to discredit and shut down liberatory movements, and we need to understand what is and what isn't anti-Semitism. We need to understand that solidarity with Palestinians, criticism of the State of Israel, and principled anti-Zionism are not anti-Semitic. And particularly, we need to resist attempts to isolate the struggle for the liberation of the land and people of Palestine from other struggles for racial and economic justice. So some of the main points we'll be making today. Charges of anti-Semitism have been used to marginalize other movements, and we'll talk a little bit about how that's looked. Zionism as an ideology and as it's borne out in practice is racist. And Zionism uses and relies on anti-Semitism to justify itself. So many Zionist institutions as well and prominent individuals who sound the alarm about anti-Semitism are involved in other racist practices. Anti-Semitism is a form of racism, but it exists in a historical context and it has some particularities. And we need to be both confronting anti-Semitism and confronting Zionism. So some things we're not saying. We're not saying there's a Zionist conspiracy. There are Zionist institutions. There is, you know, interests of Israel as a state that align with the U.S.'s imperial interests, but we're not talking about super powerful Jews and with special access to governments and stuff like that. We're not saying anti-Semitism doesn't exist or isn't a problem, but we're also not saying that anti-Jewish oppression is worse or more important than other forms of oppression. So here's one definition of anti-Semitism from April Rosenblum, who wrote a really useful zine called The Past Didn't Go Anywhere, which I would definitely recommend people checking out. A lot of the slides, especially in the introductory section, are very much influenced by her work. So anti-Semitism or anti-Jewish oppression is the system of ideas passed down through society's institutions to enable scapegoating of Jews and the ideological or physical targeting of Jews that results from that. Some common themes of, you know, anti-Semitism has manifested in a lot of different ways historically, but these are some sort of common threads that Jews are mysterious or are, you know, secretly enacting rituals. that Jews have abnormal or supernatural amounts of power, that they're disloyal to or seek the destruction of the societies they live in, and that they're disproportionately the cause of harm in the world. Also, that Jews are unlike the rest of humanity or inherently evil or tied to the devil, and that Jews are wealthy or greedy, and that Jews are like the brains behind the action. So often this comes up in discussion of anti-Semitism, like why don't we just say anti-Jewish oppression, which is in a lot of ways more accurate. The words, and a lot of times people will say too, but Arabs are Semites too. The word Semite is actually it's based in European Orientalism. It was first popularized by this guy, Wilhelm Marr, who was actually looking for a way to sort of repackage like hatred of Jews, to sound more scientific. This is around the time where sort of the pseudoscience of race is developing in Europe. So, you know, Jews didn't get to choose the name for their oppression, but mostly it's accepted as meaning the targeting of Jews. And so Christian anti-Semitism has been around for a very long time. One important piece of it is the blood libel, which is that Jews killed Jesus, and that that Jews, you know, are involved in slaying Christian children, using their blood in rituals. It was sort of propagated by the Christian church and has endured in a lot of ways. The Crusades were, you know, large-scale violence against Jews and Muslims. Expulsions and so the Inquisition in Spain is one instance in history where Jews were, you know, targeted for torture and death, along with other people. It targeted heretics, which included Muslims and others that the church had opposition to for whatever reason. And then pogroms, which probably people are familiar with. So, and in terms of expulsions, like, Jews throughout history in Europe were always, always there was the possibility of expulsion from the place that they were living. So the important thing to note about this part is that in Christian anti-Semitism, it's not just Jews. Well, it was sort of before the evolution of the concept of race, and so the main distinction between people who were human and people who were dehumanized was whether or not they were Christian. And that also played out in the colonization of the New World. If people were not Christian, if they're indigenous, then they don't have souls, and it's okay to kill them. And that's very much related to early Christian anti-Semitism. But in the 19th century, things changed. Things changed for Jews in Europe. And another thing to point out is that most of my knowledge of anti-Semitism is about European anti-Semitism. It really started in Europe and was exported, but it's important to note that as Jews live at every place in the world and are from every place in the world, they're not all European, they're not all white. So in the 19th century, Jews were emancipated, which means that they could travel more freely, work more freely. And with that, there was a rising tide of anti-Semitism. But it was also a time where the pseudoscience of race was being developed. So Jews were characterized at this point as a race, often compared to people from the African continent described as dark, also overly sexual and weak. And so sort of the historical, like the function of anti-Semitism historically was to identify, to basically scapegoat Jews, to identify a group of people as the ruling elite who weren't really the people with power. And then when things got uncomfortable for the ruling elite, when there was, you know, political tumult, it was a way to release that social pressure. But because of a lot of the restrictions on Jews, what they could and couldn't do, they were often forced into these positions where they were the intermediaries between sort of the 99% and the 1%, right? Like they were the tax collectors or other sort of unsavory positions where they were seen as the face of these oppressive policies. And just what I said before, that anti-Semitism was used to redirect anger away from the ruling elite and a pressure valve for social unrest.
What's that?
It's from a pogrom in 1905. And there are children who were killed. Okay, so, and this just sort of reinforces that I just said. This is an image.
I'm sorry.
Go back. In a world that's very difficult to change, anti-Semitism makes things seem easy to solve. It lets us fix our gaze on an imagined group of greedy, powerful Jews at the root of the world's problems and moves our eyes right past the systems that actually keep injustice in place. Capitalism, weapons dealers, oil companies, you name it, and the overwhelmingly non-Jewish ruling classes who benefit from it all. And again, that's from April Rosenberg. And this is an image after the economic collapse in Argentina. It's just an example of sort of the scapegoating of Jews at times of unrest. Okay, it says Kirchner, Jew of the IMF. And he's not Jewish, but. So talking a little bit more about where these tropes came from, controlling the world and government, and the makes and the media. I mean, this is part of Jews being restricted from a lot of different kinds of professions. At one point, they were restricted from most things, like farming, but they could be actors. So sort of like that became developed, and somehow that translated into the notion of Jews controlling the media. This is also a really common trope, causing wars or causing the loss of wars. And that goes back a long time. I mean, one very famous example was after World War I in Germany. Jews were blamed for the loss of that war. But it also, like, you'll also see that with, to some extent, like, the whole Jewish lobby argument, John Mearsheimer, and the, you know, Adbusters published this, like, list of neoconservatives, and they indicated which ones were Jews. So this, like, Jews causing wars actually is sort of an updated trope. Anyways. And so one really strong foundation of the work we do as Jewish anti-Zionists is that the way to honor the history of suffering that anti-Semitism has caused is to support the liberation struggles of all people, particularly to fight against imperialism and colonialism and racism, to which anti-Semitism and Zionism is intimately connected. So now we're going to look at some of those connections with Ruby.
First of all, we just kind of wanted to sort of like take the temperature in the room and have people maybe throw out, just popcorn style, as they say, a few definitions of Zionism, what you think Zionism is. So if anybody can just speak up, that would be wonderful. Yes?
Social justification for Palestinian oppression.
Okay.
Are you talking about historically?
However you want to take it.
Well, at one time it had a progressive image to it.
Like labor Zionism.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's a Jewish nationalism that seeks self-determination and that of Jews in Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the idea that Jews cannot be saved in this thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes, rooted in notions of sovereign territorialism.
Sovereignty or what?
Sovereign territorialism.
Territorialism, okay.
Incorporation of independence with a state. Like
okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
The idea that anti-Semitism and racism are a permanent feature of human nature.
Anybody else? Yes.
A religious mission.
A religious mission. Okay. I'm going to. Yeah. Did somebody say something?
It's a combination of a distorted definition of what Judaism is, and a nationalism, a dependency on the Old Testament. Those parts of it which imagine that it was a divine ownership of the Middle East that was mm-hmm. given to some group that they defined.
Chosen people. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to... That was cool. I'm going to talk about what our definition of Zionism is, which works in a lot of what was just said in the room. So basically, the ideology and movement on which the colonial project of Jewish-only Israeli state building in Palestine is founded and continues. Jewish nationalism, maximum land in Palestine for the state of Israel with minimum number of Palestinians, and the self-defined character of Israel as a Jewish state and the basis of its current policies. And one thing just to note here is that by founding the state of Israel, there was a consolidation of the different strands of Zionism into political Zionism, which is what is now basically the dominant ideology guiding 20th century and 21st century contemporary Zionist movement and policy, as well as U.S. policy. So things that we think of as Zionism in a historical context, for example, labor Zionism, that was kind of thrown out in the contemporary Zionism that we understand now for the most part, especially considering what guides U.S. policy and Israeli state policy. And one thing that's important to understand, too, is that we see Zionist colonization as ongoing. And I don't want to read through the whole quote, but I will start almost down at the bottom. It is a conflict between the Zionist project of colonizing Palestine and the indigenous people of the land, the Palestinian Arabs. Present-day Israel is not only a product of the Zionist colonization project, but also an instrument for its further extension and expansion. Colonization is ongoing, and that's attributed to Moshe Makover. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly, but he is a philosophy professor and co-founder of Machben, the anti-Zionist Israeli socialist organization. And just to include some context and example here, a lot of times I hear the argument that since 1967, colonization ended, or colonizing practices of the Israeli state ended in 1967, and that now we're kind of looking back on a state project that, like most state projects of the early to mid 20th century, had problems, but now we are in a new turn of the century era, and that those borders are established, and it's a conflict between two sides with equal power. and that colonization is no longer happening. But in reality, it is. And just one example is that in 2009, I mean, forced evictions are a huge issue. And in 2009, 53 Palestinian refugees were forcibly removed from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem. And then just another kind of mind-blowing number is that, and these are from Badil, which is a Palestinian resource on displacement, eviction, and colonialist practices of the state of Israel. And in, let's see, okay, so 24,813 houses were demolished between 1967 and 2009 in East Jerusalem, Gaza, and the West Bank. So that's just to illustrate the ongoing nature of colonialism, Zionist colonialism. And now I want to talk about why Zionism is racist. And this is a quote from a great essay called The Forgotten Ism, and it's an Arab-American women's perspective on Zionism, racism, and sexism. And I'm going to read the whole thing because I think it's a really great quote. The Zionist movement has not only supported the creation of the state of Israel on Palestinian land, but has supported the creation of a Jewish-only state. Within this paradigm, Zionism constructs Jews as a race or distinct ethnic group, and the state of Israel as a Jewish-only state, with non-Jews considered a demographic threat. This exclusionary logic has produced the conditions for torture, home demolitions, restriction of movement, unemployment, apartheid, and ethnic cleansing in Palestine. Any state and ideology that officially and legally privileges members of one race or ethnicity over another and establishes national identity on the basis of race or ethnicity is inherently racist. And just, this is some graffiti, and it's a star of David, or three stars of David, and it says, kill Arabs. And this is in the occupied territory. I'm not sure where it is. It's, yeah, I forgot to write that down.
Hebron,
maybe. It only happens in Hebron. Okay. Yeah, and I've seen pictures of some graffiti like that even in Gaza or on the wall, too.
What's the purpose of it being in English?
It's a universal language.
Said they're probably from Brooklyn, and also it's a universal language. Just one point, too, that I want to make. Going back to racist practices of the Israeli state and supported by Zionism is the example of the right of return. So maybe you guys already know this, but Palestinians can't go back home, and Palestinian refugees from any part of the world cannot go back home. But I, as somebody with absolutely zero physical connection to that land because my ancestors all immigrated from Europe before the establishment of the state, never had any connection to that land. I could go live there, become a naturalized citizen, and have like all rights of citizenship in Israel, whereas Palestinians can't even live in neighborhoods, homes that belonged to their families for centuries and centuries. And this is another quote that is from Yosef Weitz, who is the director of land settlement for the Jewish National Fund. And this is just, I'm just going to read it. Amongst ourselves, it must be clear that there is no room for both peoples in this country. After the Arabs are transferred, the country will be wide open for us. With the Arabs staying, the country will remain narrow and restricted. There are large Arab villages crowded in population and surrounded by cultivated land, growing olives, grapes, figs, sesame, and maize fields. Okay, thank you. Time. I'm really close. And would we be able to maintain scattered settlements among these existing villages that will always be larger than ours? And is there any possibility of buying their land? And once again, I hear the voice inside me, evacuate this country. So just an illustration of the kind of overt ethnic cleansing practices on which the state is built, which tie back to the ideology of Zionism. So just a few more points to make real quick is that we see Zionism as founded on premises that are actually anti-Semitic. And one major premise is this idea that Zionism is a way to kind of reestablish European Jewish masculinity and promote a stronger, whiter, less shtetl, less scholarly, less weak, more of the land Jewish man and we have some pretty crazy images. This says, a nation reborn on its ancestral soil. This is a poster for the Jewish National Fund. The other one, yeah, New York, you can go, you know, sign up over there. And this one says, buy local goods, which means the other one to the right, which means Jewish Israeli goods. This is, yeah, I don't think it needs much explanation. Yeah, David and Goliath, exactly. And just one more point to make is that Israel was seen prior to its establishment as a state. There was kind of a Zionist positioning that this was an opportunity for Jews to claim a piece of the colonial pie when colonialism was at its height, and that Israel, one way to sell this to other colonialist powers that could possibly back the founding of the state, was that Israel would serve as a bulwark against the savage, dark people who inhabited that land, i.e. Arabs, Palestinians. And so a quote from Theodor Herzl, who was a major architect of Zionism in the 19th century, is, he declared that if created, the Jewish state would form a portion of the rampart of Europe against Asia, an outpost of civilization as opposed to barbarism. And I think that's what we've got on Zionism for now.
I think we may move past this for now, okay. But just kind of to reiterate some of the stuff around racism and colonialism, one of the most prominent things is the very concrete military alliances that Israel had in the, you know, from the 50s on with both apartheid South Africa and white Rhodesia, and that it was centrally involved in arming both of those explicitly racist governments and was a strong ally of apartheid South Africa basically through the end, was involved in violating UN arms sales embargoes and also in diamond and helping support the diamond trade in violation of the UN embargoes. And so just that it's allied itself historically with other racist regimes around the world.
Okay,
all right. So I'm Noah, for those of you who have just joined us or don't remember. So I'm going to talk a little bit about case studies in the compilation, if that's the right word, probably not, trying to tar liberatory movements with being anti-Semitic and how that sort of takes place. So one we're probably all pretty familiar with is ABC7's coverage of anti-Semitism at Occupy Chicago. So these are just some quotes from the story that ran on ABC7 that I thought best illustrated the tricky nature of these master propagandists. So this is from Chuck Gowdy, I think I'm saying his name right, his story. So it begins with, as hostilities increase from coast to coast with tear gas and flash bombs in Oakland, overnight arrests in Atlanta, and a battle of wits is underway in Chicago, a strain of nasty anti-Semitism grows in the Occupy Wall Street ranks. So the clip of that on the television begins with the flash bombs in Oakland and all that kind of stuff. So it's not a very subtle trick, obviously, but on the one hand, he's got the idea of this riot-like behavior that you see happening, and tying that directly to anti-Semitism as it's growing at the Occupy, within Occupy Wall Street ranks, which is interesting for a number of reasons. One of the major reasons I find it interesting is because one of the people they talk to is this fellow Lonnie Nassiter, and here he says, there have been some isolated incidents throughout the country that have clearly alarmed us. So on the one hand, the story is saying that that anti-Semitism is on the growth, is growing. And here their expert opinion is saying that there are some isolated incidents that have alarmed them. As, you know, I think probably anybody who's remotely sensitive was probably alarmed by anti-Semitism anywhere. But this is Chuck Gowdy's tying that alarm of some small events happening into this kind of central idea or growing movement within Occupy. So, yes, and it goes on to say that Nassatir is the director of the Anti-Defamation League in Chicago, and the ADL officials across the country are monitoring the protests. So this gives us an idea of, like, essentially to me, he's creating this narrative that, one, anti-Semitism is growing in the Occupy movement, and that it's of such a concern that the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, is monitoring it throughout the Occupy movements. Which, in reality, strikes me as pretty unlikely that it's so out of control that ABC needed to rush out and do this kind of story on it. So let's see. Oh, and then here we come to kind of how they wrap up the story. The I-Team asked a spokesperson for the Occupy Chicago group about the small number of anti-Semitic demonstrators and why a Palestinian flag was displayed outside of Mayor Emanuel's office and why a Palestinian activist would speak about Israel at one of their recent events. So here again, another tricky move is to equate Palestinian liberation, Palestinian, you know, symbols with being anti-Semitic. And I'm not it seems pretty obvious that that's ridiculous. But I think, as you can see in interviews with people from, like, the ADL, et cetera, that's just part of the parlance, is Palestinian, any kind of assertion of Palestinian rights or autonomy or independence or history even. Sure, you can all remember when whoever that woman is that has a cooking show got in trouble for wearing what might have been a keffiyeh in a donut commercial. Like, this was a big deal. She was wearing a scarf that Yasser Arafat was known to have worn, and therefore it meant there was some kind of support for terrorism. You figure it out, because I can't. I mean, but obviously this is not unique to sort of Palestinian liberation or other kinds of liberatory movements. Saw the same thing, I think, happen with the incidences of sexual assault that were noted at Occupy Wall Street. And now it's pretty common. Certainly, if you ever happen to see mainstream media, that becomes what Occupy is. Occupy is the anti-Semitic movement where sexual assault happens. So they don't have to talk about the real problems, obviously. Okay, so let me see if this works.
No.
Okay, good. So we discovered that doesn't work. Okay, so what you would have seen is a let me take a step back. So one of the things that came out of sort of the claims of anti-Semitism in the Occupy Wall Street, etc. movement was this committee called the Emergency Committee for Israel, and they put together like a 2-minute video that does very similar things to the ABC 7 story. So it has one of the kind of centerpieces of it is a young guy who's talking to a fellow in a kippah, and he's saying, "You don't speak English, go back to Israel. You control all the money, Jews." So that was one guy at Occupy Wall Street, and that was kind of the centerpiece of this little propaganda piece about how the Occupy movement is virulently anti-Semitic, and therefore you don't have to take it seriously, and you can feel good about fighting against it. So who is the Emergency Committee for Israel? This is their self-description. The Emergency Committee for Israel is committed to mounting an active defense of the U.S.-Israeli relationship by educating the public about the positions of political candidates on this important issue, by keeping the public informed of the latest developments in both countries. Join us to help support Israel and her many friends here in the United States. So, this is the board of the Emergency Committee for Israel. These are like...
Sorry, it should be Rachel Abrams.
Yes, not Rachel Adams, not to be confused with the lovely Rachel McAdams from some of our favorite films. It's Rachel Abrams. So Rachel, these folks are like sort of, you know, classic neocons. They all have connections to the certainly the Republican movement, and if I'm not mistaken, they were all to a degree connected to the Reagan administration. Rachel Abrams is the wife of Elliot Abrams. You might remember him if you've ever read about the Iran-Contra scandal. So if you're interested to know about them, feel free to read through, but I'll just give you an idea here. So why am I bringing up the Emergency Committee for Israel? I think because it shows there is a, at the very least, there's an ideological intersection between the conservative movement and the Zionist movement. And the Israeli Committee, Emergency Committee for Israel, is an example of that, but it does exist in other ways. For example, I'm going to move on into...
Can I add a little bit about that? So, I mean, what I think is significant about the Emergency Committee for Israel, and another person who was involved with it is Newt Gingrich. And so here are these people who are very concerned about anti-Semitism, and yet they're perfectly invested in promoting every other kind of racism and other forms of oppression. So you have Newt Gingrich, whose whole career in the 90s was criminalizing black people, right? And yet he's very concerned about anti-Semitism. And so I want to talk a little bit about the ideological function of it. Like, I think it's obvious, the disconnect, perhaps, to us, but it's also really insidious, because what they're doing is they're working to both to marginalize and isolate Palestinian solidarity work and people who are confronting Zionism and saying this is separate and don't go there, because if you go there, you're inviting charges of anti-Semitism. So on the one hand, they're using it to isolate that struggle from other struggles, and they've been frighteningly successful in that. And then on the other hand, what they're doing is they're marginalizing the whole Occupy movement, or at least they're attempting to undermine the message by saying that it's anti-Semitic. And so I think that that's kind of what's underpinning it, and that it's a really conscious and it's like a planned effort. It's not just about ideological alignment. I think I would take it one step further and say that they're actually actively working together. And I wouldn't be surprised if the Chuck Gowdy piece originated from the Emergency Committee for Israel video. So I just wanted to add those few pieces about that.
Yeah. Okay, so this brings us back to, at least in my thinking, to anti-Semitic tropes that we were talking about. And I think one of the responses that I often give when I'm confronted with people who say, the left, whatever that's supposed to mean, is anti-Semitic because it supports Palestinians and so on. I think, as I'm about to illustrate, anti-Semitism isn't unique to a particular part of the political spectrum. And I'm going to illustrate this, the anti-Semitic tropes that are part of the pro-Israel Christian Zionist movement. And you've probably already read a number of them. But these are, I'm going to talk about a couple of people that are sort of prime examples. And I would venture to say that they're amongst the leaders of sort of the hardcore Christian Zionist movement. And Christian Zionism doesn't start with these people. It actually has a long history going back to the early 1900s at least with...
It predates Jewish Zionism.
There we go, yes. Well said. It predates Jewish Zionism. Okay, so you guys probably know who John Hagee is. He obviously endorsed John McCain. Eventually, John McCain distanced himself from him because of, amongst other things, this quote. So John Hagee, referring to Jews and why the Holocaust happened, said their own rebellion had birthed the seed of anti-Semitism that would arise and bring destruction to them for centuries to come. It arises from the judgment of God upon his rebellious chosen people. So, I mean, yes, we're entering into, fantasy land, so it gets we're through the looking glass, as might be said. This is from his book, Jerusalem Countdown, A Prelude to War. And so here we get this idea that Jews are responsible for their oppression and their targeting, and that it's a fulfillment of God's plan. And this is a jumping-off point for other Christian Zionists who believe that Jews have to return to Israel in order for prophecy to be fulfilled, so Jesus will come back. And then who knows what will happen to the Jews, although it has been said that a third of them are going to be saved and two-thirds of them are going to be damned to hell or things of that nature. So here we go back to this idea that if you're not Christian, you don't have a soul or in some way your soul is not is defective or not as good as a Christian soul. So John Hagee is quoted as saying, they are physically alive, but they're not spiritually alive, referring to Jews. And one of his central claims is that in order to become spiritually alive, it's not even so much about becoming Christian as it is about returning to Israel. And John Hagee is like a big fundraiser for Zionist organizations, and he Elie Wiesel has spoken at his church and so on. So he's closely aligned with the Zionist movement, not just from the kind of mainstream political parties in Israel, but also I think most people in the mainstream would think of Elie Wiesel as a fairly liberal sort of thinker and writer. So this quote is taken from a sermon he gave at his church in late 2005 in San Antonio, Texas, and it was broadcast and widely. Okay, so now this brings us to God TV, which I feel like there's a joke there, but maybe it's just God TV. So God TV is the brainchild of two, a husband and wife team, are sort of at the head of the organization. And John Hagee is a regular guest and contributor to that network. They're, you can get them online if you're interested. And one of their big charitable things is to support the Jewish National Fund. And this is a sign that is was anyway put up on in the Negev desert, and they have this plan to plant a million trees in the Negev, and so there's a Palestinian village, Al Arakib, in the Negev, which has been demolished, I believe, 30 times now.
34
times. It's populated by Bedouins, and I believe they're Israeli citizens, but obviously they're of Palestinian origin. And so God TV is actively helping to destroy that community as part of a charitable act. Okay, so that wraps it up. I want to toss it over to you. Sorry.
But we'll kind of share a little bit,
okay.
Right?
Sure, yeah.
So the next thing that we want to talk about is the Durban World Conference Against Racism, and similar to what Noah was doing, using this as an example to illustrate the ways in which charges of anti-Semitism can take over and divide movements for liberation. So just a little bit of context on Durban. The first conference was held in Durban, South Africa, in 2001, and it was really focused on the legacy of racism and slavery in African and Caribbean countries, with two key demands: the acknowledgement that slavery and colonialism constituted crimes against humanity under international law, and that countries that perpetrated and profited from these crimes begin to repair that damage through reparations. Another part of this conversation, too, was debt cancellation, and there began to be a real movement at that time, some of you might remember, calling for debt cancellation from the IMF and World Bank. And so, really, Durban was very centered around a coming together of civil rights movement in the United States, creating ties and alliances to build one large movement with calls from African and Caribbean countries that were all calling for the aforementioned reparations and recognition also by the UN of slavery as a crime against humanity. And so around this time, there was kind of, there began to be conversation coming from more G8 sorts of countries, the United States included. Condoleezza Rice said, we are better to look forward and not point fingers backwards. So there was some real fear stirring up from the white powerful countries that would have something to lose should this movement really materialize as it was doing. And around that time, controversy around Zionism began to emerge. And so 6 months before Durban, just to back up a little bit, the way that UN declarations usually work, my understanding is that there are various drafts that are sent in months before a conference in which a declaration will be decided upon, and these are then gone over at the conference, and a final declaration is created and decided upon somewhat collaboratively at the event itself. And so 6 months before Durban, a few Islamic countries requested language in the draft that they were working on that used words like apartheid and genocide to describe Israeli policies in the occupied territories. And then a month before the conference, some more changes that made it into headlines included references to the Holocaust in lowercase instead of uppercase H, references to pluralized Holocausts, and references to ethnic cleansing of the Arab population in historic Palestine, and clauses such as racist practices of Zionism. And so this was what started to kind of catch headlines and created an impetus for the United States to boycott the first Durban conference, along with a number of other countries, including, I don't know, New Zealand, Switzerland,
Israel.
Israel, yeah. And so, just to be clear, there were actual instances of anti-Semitism at Durban 1, but this was in the NGO forum, which is a parallel meeting of civil society, not under UN control, more than 8,000 participants. And just some examples, there were the Arab Lawyers Guild passed out some propaganda that had anti-Semitic cartoons. There was also a manifesto created at that NGO forum that had language which equated Zionism with racism, just so that you all have a context of what was eventually created out of these examples.
I was just going to reinforce that ultimately it was very convenient for the U.S. to have an excuse to pull out of this conference because they were threatened with actual reparations for slavery, which, you know, the U.S. did not want. So I don't think it's so much about concern about anti-Semitism so much as an excuse not to address issues of racial justice in the U.S.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I just wanted to underline that the organizing leading up to that conference was really significant and was, you know, cross-national, was across the Atlantic, it was based in Africa, it was also based in the U.S. and in the Caribbean, and so there were all of these forces coming together to push, because the deal is if you declare something a crime against humanity, then there's no longer a statute of limitations, and so if there's not a statute of limitations, you can push for reparations now. And so by getting it declared, so that was really a material threat to the U.S. and Europe, and that they might have to pay reparations. And so, right, exactly what Emma said, it provided a convenient out.
So the U.S. formally withdrew from Durban within the first few days of the conference, supposedly because of the clauses about Israel in one of the drafts that I spoke about earlier. Just to note, none of that language actually made it into the final draft of the declaration. And just to illustrate the fact that at the time, this was considered a victory by there's a quote from the Israeli Foreign Prime Minister Shimon Peres, who said it was an accomplishment of the first order for Israel and a painful come down for the Arab League. So an understanding coming from the Israeli state that that the threat had diminished. And as Lee and Emma mentioned, in the end, Durban had some real success because the final declaration became the first document with international standing to name slavery and the slave trade as a crime against humanity, and the State Department was very concerned about this, obviously, because it created a legal framework for some real work to be done. Yes?
Yeah, I think we have a typo in there. I think.
What does it say?
Israeli foreign prime minister, is that what it says? I think he was the foreign minister.
Sorry.
Or the prime minister.
Not the prime minister.
Current president.
He was the Israeli foreign minister. And then shortly after this victory, September 11th hit. So I think the conference was over like September 8th and then September 11th. And the events of September 11th kind of had a two-prong impact. One was that all talk of reparations were kind of put on the back burner. But in addition, there began to be this development of a false connection between the anti-Semitism at Durban and the terrorist act that was 9/11. And so we have Tom Lantos, the late U.S. congressman, saying, "Hate is the thread that connects Durban and the terrorism of September 11th, and it is the same ideology that produced terrorists such as Osama bin Laden. The terrorist attacks on September 11th demonstrated the evil such hate can spawn." And then Erwin Kotler, Canada's foreign justice minister, said, "If 9/11 was the Kristallnacht of terror, Durban was the Mein Kampf." So, you know, crazy. And had a huge, horrible material impact. It was even described in the Jerusalem Post as an anti-Jewish diplomatic pogrom. So complete inflation of a few incidents of anti-Semitism that turned into a real destruction of what Durban was meant to be. And this is an example of one of many, many cartoons painting Durban as anti-Semitic. And so just some immediate consequences of Durban 1 was that the Ford Foundation was targeted because the Ford Foundation funded a lot of grassroots organizations that had taken delegations to Durban or grassroots organizations that did work with Arab populations in the U.S. And so there was a lot of defunding and auditing of Arab organizations, requirement of loyalty oaths, which I'm not going to get into because time. And also, yeah.
He was just asking. He's not saying that.
Oh, you weren't?
10 after 6.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
10 after 6, everyone.
10 after 6. So loyalty oaths were something that the Ford Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation developed in response to this kind of witch hunt that went on from, just to be clear, where the pressure was coming from, a whole host of Zionist NGOs kind of sprang up in the wake of the first Durban conference to monitor the UN and the Durban process and call it out as an anti-Semitic free-for-all, Kristallnacht of terror, or Mein Kampf, I don't remember. So, yeah, both. So basically, these loyalty oaths, Ford and Rockefeller started requiring all of their grant recipients to vow that they would not promote or engage in violence, terrorism, bigotry, or the destruction of any state. Also, the Jewish Telegraphic Agency ran an essay called Funding Hate that was aimed at outing all of the foundations. I mean, the main target was the Ford Foundation, but really outing all of the foundations that had financed the Durban NGO Forum. And when Durban 2, which was the review conference for Durban 1 to review the original declaration, was announced, and it was in Geneva in 2009, these same NGOs started putting forth a really, really prolific propaganda campaign. Their websites just became full of videos and slideshows of anti-Semitic cartoons and signs from Durban 1. There were hundreds and hundreds of articles produced and press releases and Durban 2 alerts, all of which served to basically call out, to smear the Durban process and to call it out as being an anti-Semitic and, you know, completely empty, empty process. And many of the articles that were published, and they were published in pretty well-known U.S. newspapers like the Wall Street Journal, the New York Daily News, many of these articles contained completely false and distorted information that had no connection to the actual conference. One example was they said it was chaired by Libya with Iran and Cuba as vice chairs, which is ridiculous. And so many governments were getting their information from these accounts, I mean, as well as, goes without saying, the general public, and was starting to really, the propaganda campaign was working. People were starting to believe that Durban was a horrible, racist, anti-Semitic event, and that the declaration was had no standing and was a joke, basically. I mean, Durban was a joke, was a huge, that phrase was a huge tagline of the movement. Durban is a joke. It was repeated constantly in many forms. And so when the UN found out that most of the, not just the general public, but many of the governments involved who were going to be represented at Durban 2 were getting their information from these false accounts and not from the actual original documents that were produced at Durban, they put out a statement to kind of try to level it out, and immediately the, you know, trying to set the record straight, immediately this network of NGOs fired back and said that the UN statements were intended to conjure up xenophobic and stereotypical images of the Jewish lobby, and that the High Commissioner's office was playing on imagery reminiscent of that which was circulated at Durban 1. So, as was to be kind of expected, although the UN High Commissioner did, and others involved in Durban 2 did try really, really hard to get Obama to participate in Durban 2. And one of the things that they did, which is pretty unusual, is they created a final document, a final declaration for Durban 2, and didn't provide any of the same opportunities for a review process that went on at Durban 1. And the reason for doing this was to kind of lure Obama and the other countries that they knew would go with the U.S. if there was a U.S. boycott to the conference. And so any language having to do with there was no mention of Palestine or Israel in the final declaration. There was no mention of reparations. There was no mention of slavery being a crime against humanity, of really, there wasn't even a mention of the transatlantic slave trade at all. So something that went from being a conference that was pretty focused, its main point was to really undo start working to undo the damage of colonialism, slavery, and racism in a global community, as they call the UN, was basically completely ripped to shreds just in the very act of trying to lure Obama and G8 countries to the conference. And even despite this kind of initial watering down, Obama still boycotted the Durban Review Conference, along with Australia, Canada, Germany, Israel, Italy, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Poland, and the Czech Republic. Human rights organizations that had been really key in the original Durban conference also boycotted the conference. So one example is Human Rights Watch, also Amnesty International. So really, it worked. And just a few more examples. The Israel Project, a 5.5 million operation claiming to provide journalists and politicians with accurate information about Israel, estimates that they spent about $500,000 on Durban 2. And there was the Zionist NGOs that popped up after Durban 1, their delegates just vastly outnumbered all other groups. So they had 150 delegates total, and Human Rights Watch had 3, NAACP had 0. And this is from a movement that the original Durban 1, the U.S., various civil rights-oriented organizations in the U.S., I think sent 2,000 African-American delegates to the first conference. And then, I don't know total numbers, but we go to the NAACP having 0. It's crazy. And, yeah.
Can I please. Mm-hmm. So just kind of the biggest implications of the World Conference Against Racism and the review conferences is one was up there that anti-Semitism misrepresentation was very useful for states who want to duck dealing with the issues, right? So one, it gave states a way out of not dealing with the issues. Two, it marginalized the whole process. Three, what it did was it started to create this sense among some activists that the Palestinian struggle was trumping their struggle. And so it created tension among the activists in a way that further marginalized the organizing, isolated the Palestinians, and weakened the entire movement. And so thinking about the way that this claim of anti-Semitism was used to both create divisions within the movement and also to marginalize it is what I think is kind of the biggest takeaway from the World Conference Against Racism and the stuff around that. Do you have more to add on it?
I was just going to talk just a little bit to wrap this up about Durban 3 and just the way in which the Durban process has played out. So in New York in September 2011, there was a conference called the Durban Declaration and Program of Action, and that was victims of racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia, and related intolerance, recognition, justice, and development. That was the subtitle. And most of the member states of the UN attended, and there were the U.S. once again boycotted, as did all of the other countries up there, which I think were the same ones I read off last time. And there were just similar efforts to brand this third conference as anti-Israel and anti-Semitic. And there was going back to what Noah spoke about with Christian Zionism, there was a huge demonstration that, with the largest contingent being participants from the Christian, evangelical Christian community. And this is a picture from one of those demonstrations. This is Americans for a Safe Israel. That's a member from that group. And so clearly some very horrible racist messaging taking place outside. And this was part. This demonstration also kind of went hand in hand with a counter summit organized by the NGO UN Watch, and that was they called it "We Have a Dream: Global Summit Against Discrimination and Persecution," and that took place next to Durban 3, and it was a coalition of many different Zionist NGOs and other NGOs in solidarity with them, and I think just to briefly talk about outcomes, but kind of this is mostly Lee already kind of went over this, but it really weakened the Durban process and the Durban Declaration and marginalized it to the point of it going from, you know, it went from having really some really good standing to really no standing at all. And I think everything else we already talked about. So it... That's the end. It is actually the end of our slideshow, but it's not the end of the talk. So, Emma, do you want to...
I have a little that I'd like to add. So just a couple other things we wanted to talk about is the role that... I mean, one thing that we haven't really addressed and may just... There's a lot that we wanted to cover, and we also want to leave time for discussion. But so one thing is about... thinking about the material realities and the material consequences of anti-Semitism now and the material consequences of other forms of racism and oppression, I think is important in terms of contextualizing it and the way that anti-Semitism gets privileged and makes sure that we're not buying into that at the same time as we are addressing anti-Semitism in a real substantive way when it comes up, but not privileging it. So the other thing I want to speak briefly to is the role of certain Zionist institutions in promoting racism while their stated purpose is defending against anti-Semitism. So one example is the Simon Wiesenthal Center, whose mission is to build museums of tolerance, and they have one in LA, one in New York, and they're building one in Jerusalem. And so their stated mission is to build these museums of tolerance and combat anti-Semitism and racism, and so school groups are often mandated to go to these museums, and they go to these museums, and there are all of these displays about slavery and about the Holocaust and kind of this sensationalized, racialized violence. And they get to the end of it, and they watch a video that's about the threat of Muslim terrorism, right? And so it's, on the one hand, they're kind of in a way strategically saying we're against all of these forms, and then at the same time targeting another group, right? And this is reflected, their quote-unquote Museum of Tolerance in Jerusalem is being built on top of the Mamilla Cemetery, which is an ancient Palestinian Muslim graveyard. And then finally they came out against the Park 51 project in New York, the quote-unquote Ground Zero Mosque. And so they've been actively fomenting kind of anti-Muslim and anti-Arab racism at the same time as they're supposedly against all intolerance. And the Anti-Defamation League came up in our slideshow, and it's worth mentioning that they also, their stated purpose is to confront anti-Semitism, but the bulk of their work is in countering people who are working for Palestinian rights, and so they pour much of their money into one thing that ADL has been very heavily involved in is surveilling movements, and that, you know, they have records on thousands of groups. This was, I think, a lot of what's come out has been in the 80s around the anti-apartheid movement and various other organizations. And they also have been involved in training police forces. There's a lot of money now, post September 11th, for training police forces, and they're very involved in that and getting funding and trained thousands of police officers, probably around issues of anti-Semitism, and yet also promoting anti-Arab and anti-Muslim racism at the same time. So I guess, do we want to wrap up? So I guess we'll wrap up, thank you, and we will take questions or have a discussion. I guess maybe we can start with questions. Did you have something?
Yeah, I just...